Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Eric Westerveld. It's Here and Now. Russia says the U.S., Great Britain, and France violated international law and hurt the peace process by launching air and missile strikes against Syria last weekend. You might ask, what peace process? French President Emmanuel Macron today defended the military action. He said the Assad regime can't get away with using chemical weapons. After the attack in Syria, Senators Bob Corker and Tim Kaine are leading a bipartisan push for a new authorization for the use of military force. Senator Kaine joins us now. And Senator, you did not support the president's decision to strike Syria. Why not?
Well, I would support them in all likelihood if the president would come to Congress for permission. I don't think a president can wage war against a sovereign nation. I don't think a president can do that without Congress. The president had ample warning. These chemical weapons attacks had been occurring for months. He could have come to Congress and sought congressional approval as required by Article 1 of the Constitution. So I believe, just as I believed when President Obama was president with respect to Libya or missile strikes in Syria after chemical weapons attacks in 2014, that we can't give the president a blank check. The president's not a king. The president's got to come to Congress, make a case, and lay out a strategy. That's the other important thing. Uh-huh. Military action isn't an end. It's a means to an end. But if they don't come and discuss with us what the strategy is, it's hard to assess whether the tactics that they're using are going to be successful.
Let's take authorization first. The current authorization of military forces was passed just after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. How would your proposed legislation update that authorization? I mean, we have U.S. forces on the ground now in harm's way from Syria to the Philippines.
You're right. The 9/11 authorization, partly because it was passed in a time of, just extreme emergency, was not carefully thought out. I don't think anybody felt like it was going to be used 17 years down the road. It had no time limitation, no geographic limitation, and no real description of who it was we were fighting against. So what Senator Corker and I do is we try to put some definition to the war against non-state terrorist groups. We also make plain that it is not an authorization that can be used to justify military action against a sovereign nation like Syria or Iran or North Korea. This is about non-state groups. That's what the 2001 authorization was about. And if a president wants to wage war against a sovereign nation, he would have to come to us separately on that.
So something against Syria or North Korea, he'd have to come back to Congress and get a specific authorization.
That's right. I'm very, very worried that this president, if he's allowed to just launch military action against Syria on his own, he'll think he can do the same thing against Iran and North Korea or other nations. And so that's why we're specifying that this update of the 2001 authorization is, as was originally contemplated, just to authorize military action against non-state terrorist groups.
Why hasn't Congress updated these old military authorizations before?
Congress has realized since the start that a war vote is tough, that a war vote will have unforeseen and negative consequences. And so there's been sort of a tendency to allow the executive to overreach and then say, well, if it works out, we were with you all the time, Mr. President. And if it doesn't, how dare you do this? I think there's a real lack of backbone. That's part of it. And then the second issue, which is a little fairer to Congress, I would say, is drafting a war authorization against non-state terrorist groups can be a little bit difficult. A sovereign nation, you can define it easily. Sovereign nations generally follow Geneva Conventions. The geographic description tends to be relatively straightforward. But non-state terrorist groups splinter, change their names, don't respect geographic boundaries. What we do is we basically say this is an authorization against the Taliban, ISIS, and Al-Qaeda, and groups that are closely associated with them engaging in hostilities against the United States.
Senator, stepping back and looking at strategy, the Trump administration says it has a coherent military and diplomatic strategy for dealing with Syria's seemingly intractable civil war. Do you agree they do?
I don't. I think there was a very coherent strategy that was continuous between the Obama and Trump administrations in terms of defeating ISIS in Syria. And after Raqqa fell, that battlefield defeat was fairly plain. But then we've heard all kinds of rationales asserted for why U.S. troops need to stay in Syria. We're going to have a closed-door session later today with Secretary Mattis, the entire Senate, and those strategic questions, exactly what is the mission in Syria now, I know will be top of mind for all the committee members.
Senator, do you think the missile strikes had any discernible impact on the Assad regime to stop him from using chemical weapons?
They could. I think it'll take a little bit of time to figure that out. And again, in 2014, when President Obama wanted to try to do the same thing, I encouraged him to come to Congress. He did in the Foreign Relations Committee. I voted yes. I represent the most pro-military state in the country, and I have a child in the military. I am very, very focused on this issue that we shouldn't allow a president to commit our troops to kill or be killed unless there's been a congressional debate and vote and a judgment through that vote that the mission is in the national interest.
Senator Tim Kaine, a Virginia Democrat, is a member of the Foreign Relations and Armed Services Committees. Senator Kaine, thanks.
You bet, Eric.
The U.S. has a lot of natural gas right now, thanks largely to fracking. So a handful of companies are planning to build ports to ship liquefied natural gas around the world. One of the places they want to build is Texas, and that could make the state a key source of energy for developing economies. But as Houston Public Media's Travis Bubenik reports, there are big risks involved in these multi-billion dollar projects.
Near Freeport, on the Texas Gulf Coast, crews are building three massive complexes of steel and pipe that'll liquefy the gas. They're called trains because, well...
if you look down from the sky below, it looks like a train.
Robert Pate oversees the Freeport LNG facility. He says the gas will shoot through these pipes fast.
From the time the molecule crosses our meter station until it's liquid back in these lines, 10 minutes.
Most LNG from the U.S. currently goes to Mexico, but Pate's company is betting on increased demand from Asia, mostly from China. And that bet is a big change from the company's original strategy. Back in the early 2000s, the plan was to import gas, but when fracking unleashed huge amounts of new domestic gas, the market completely flipped.
I was surprised. I think the whole industry was caught off guard.
Sig Cornelius is Freeport LNG's president.
We did not import one cargo of LNG through our facilities like we thought we were.
Cornelius knows that markets could change again, but says his $14 billion project has safeguards in place.
We have 20-year tolling agreements where the companies have commitments to use our facilities, and if they do not use the facilities, they pay for that capacity regardless.
Still, there are upwards of $75 billion being pumped into plans for other export terminals up and down the Gulf Coast. And the fact that the global dynamics of all this changed so quickly before makes you wonder, could the industry get it wrong again?
There is a distinct risk that they may have.
Michelle Foss heads up the Center for Energy Economics at the University of Texas at Austin. The terminals already being built might be safe, thanks to those long-term contracts. But Foss says a next wave of planned LNG projects might not be so lucky. Natural gas prices are already low, and they could fall some more. On top of that, Foss has seen research showing some of the foreign customers buying Texas gas have shaky credit. Other factors are just hard to predict.
It's impossible to look at a lot of these countries and try to figure out, you know, what will their gas demand be and how much of that gas demand will be satisfied by imports and where are those going to come from? Are they going to come from the U.S. or will they come from some other place? I mean, it is really difficult.
And then there's the whole China thing.
Trade war.
Trade war.
Trade war.
As China reacts to our proposed tariffs, will they do something to limit the import of LNG going forward?
Bob Harvey is the president of the Greater Houston Partnership. He and other Houston leaders just got back from a trade mission to China. He says the country is still hungry for Texas LNG for now, but he worries about the recent tit-for-tat over tariffs.
Just the very threat that we're going to have an ongoing trade dispute with China will make it very difficult to kind of consummate these deals.
And perhaps more pressing, Harvey says the White House's tariffs on imported steel would add cost to LNG terminals still in the works, possibly, he says, making them fail. Freeport LNG wants to expand even beyond what it's already building. The company's president says those tariffs, if fully applied, would raise the cost for that by hundreds of millions of dollars. For Here and Now, I'm Travis Bubenik in Houston.
got this note now. Bryce Harper of the Washington Nationals has cemented his status as Major League Baseball's leading home run hitter this season. And he did so last night in spectacular fashion.
And Lobatone setting up inside. The barrel of the bat flew all the way to the screen. And look at this! See you later on a broken bat.
Harper shattered his bat on a 96-mile-an-hour fastball from Mets pitcher Jacob deGrom. A broken bat means the ball has made poor contact with the bat, but somehow Harper managed to muscle out a homer anyway. The home run propelled the Nationals to victory over the New York Mets. Bryce Harper is not the first player to score a broken bat homer. Nelson Cruz, Mike Napoli, and Barry Bonds are among those to join the club. And in 1987, Angels outfielder Jack Howell electrified the crowd at Yankee Stadium with a broken bat home run that even stunned veteran broadcaster Vin Scully.
Breaks his bat and hits a drive to right field. It's a broken bat home run.
How do you like that?
It? Check the bat, right?
Check the bat is right. The broken part went beyond first base.
And they want to check it, too. That's the first broken bat home run I've ever seen.
Ever. Seats. I can't believe it. They want the bat. Pinella wants that bat.
And everybody's hollering the bat.
The frontman of The Who, Roger Daltrey, told his fans in a concert in Las Vegas last month that he uses hearing aids on stage. And earlier this year, rock legend Eric Clapton told the BBC he's also losing his hearing.
You know, the only thing I'm concerned with now is being in my 70s and being able to be proficient. I mean, I'm going deaf, I've got tinnitus, my hands just about work. It's amazing to myself that I'm still here.
Sting, Ozzy Osbourne, and Pete Townsend have also said that they're losing their hearing after a long career in music. But as Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reports, the problem is not confined to aging rockers.
It's a problem for classical musicians, too. The viola you're hearing is in the hands of Betty Hauk. She's playing a Bach cantata behind the vocals of the great Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. The recording was released in 2003, another high point in Betty's long career. She's performed at the White House for the Kennedys. She's played in a string quartet with Yo-Yo Ma. She's toured in the Middle East. But 7 years ago, at the age of 65, Betty just quit.
I completely turned my back on music. I didn't want to have anything to do with music whatsoever. If I couldn't play up to the level that I was used to, I wasn't going to do it.
Because Betty couldn't hear. She can't say for sure if it's her career in music that led to her moderate to severe hearing loss, but it's easy to make the connection. Researchers say decades of exposure to the sounds of an orchestra like this one can take their toll. According to one German study, professional musicians were nearly four times more likely to experience noise-induced hearing loss. Another found that nearly 60% of classical musicians have damaged hearing. For Betty, the loss was gradual.
And I hid the fact that I had hearing loss. I didn't want people to know because I felt it would affect my professional career, life.
Because your colleagues sitting next to you would think she needs her ears.
Yes, they think, oh, well, if she can't hear, maybe we shouldn't hire her as a musician anymore. I just didn't want people to know. I was like Beethoven. He also didn't want people to know when he started to lose his hearing. So at a rehearsal, I would wear my hearing aids at rehearsal so I could hear what, there was a conductor, so I could hear what he was saying, what my stand partner was saying. But I'd take them off for the concert because the music sounded much better without the hearing aids. Then it reached the point where I thought, you know, I really need to wear them during the concert, too.
And why? Then, because then the music started to sound wrong? You couldn't follow the music?
Well, I started to not be able to hear things, that they weren't loud enough. And also, if I'd play very high, a couple of times I was playing very high, I couldn't hear it. So I didn't know if I was playing in tune or not. And then one day, I was playing a Bach cantata at Emmanuel Church in Boston, where I had played regularly. And I realized there was this passage, which is called a recitative, and it's closer to the spoken voice. And the conductor kind of stops conducting there sometimes, so you just have to hear the singer and follow her. I realize I didn't have a clue where she was. It was total guesswork. I had to tell from when other people's bows were moving. And it was torture. It was torture. I knew that I was struggling, and I thought, okay, that's it. I'm out of here.
You quit just right
I
then.
I quit. I quit on the spot. I didn't want to put anyone, any of my colleagues, in the very awkward position of telling me that it was time to stop playing.
Leading up to that moment, what was your anxiety like? You must have seen this coming.
I did. My anxiety was very great.
Your career was on the line.
Yes. I played three more concerts, and they were all Bach. I played the Bach B minor Mass. I played a Bach cantata at Emmanuel, and I played some Bach at the Marlborough Bach Festival. And that was the last thing I played. And actually, a father of a student of mine was at the concert. He came up after the concert, and he came over to me, and he said, I understand this is your last concert. And this is where I get choked up. I was there with the other viola players, and he said, let's just take a moment and think about that. And I lost it at that point.
For the next 3 years, Betty silenced herself. She didn't play the viola, and she did not admit to herself the gravity of what had just happened. Not only was her career over, but the music that had sustained that career was gone too.
I had decided that I was going to treat my hearing loss as a neutral event. And it's kind of take a Buddhist approach and think it's neither good nor bad, but it's just something that's happened to me.
In those 3 years when you weren't playing, how were you feeling?
I was very depressed, and I was in denial about what a huge loss it had been.
It was not a neutral event.
It was not a neutral event. It was a huge loss. But first you have to grieve. That was what hit me. This is what I have not done. And I started grieving for the hearing loss because it was a huge loss. And as a result of that, I discovered the sweetness on the other side.
Here we go. Asa.
Sarah.
Today, her life sounds very different.
Charlie.
Awa.
Whiskey.
Apa.
Papa.
Aga.
Every few weeks, she travels to a Boston suburb for therapy with an auditory trainer named Jeff Plant. He's holding a screen over his face so that Betty can't see his lips move. She has to rely on her ears and her hearing aids to respond to Jeff's prompts.
Papa Tango.
Teach Peach.
Tango Papa.
Piatia.
Papa Tango.
Ta Pa.
Tango Papa.
How would you rank that?
That was harder.
This is one of the things that I think for most people with normal hearing, they don't have any perception of the fact that listening can be extremely hard work for someone with a hearing loss. So you can do it, but it requires enormous amounts of effort and concentration. And so to do this task for 2 minutes is really asking someone to push very, very hard.
Was it almost like a physical experience?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And my brain really feels challenged by something like that.
If you didn't have your hearing aids in right now, how would you do?
I would probably do terribly. I probably wouldn't get any of it.
And Betty has finally picked up her instruments again.
Bach? Well, you said that's one of your specialties.
That's one of the things I brought, yes.
Oh, good.
I also have some fiddle tunes. Does that sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay.
She started playing small concerts at churches and senior centers for people who could use her help. Tonight, she's in a living room with a few friends. They're drinking wine and eating cheese. They are not musicians, but they can relate.
You know, what I miss most is the Messiah.
A few years ago, Bob Broecker fell off the third step of a ladder and hit his head. Nothing has sounded the same since.
At the holidays, I would sit and we have like a 6-record set of the Messiah, and I would sit in the living room and everyone go to bed and I would listen to the Messiah and just turn flip records after another.
When you listen to the Messiah now, can you hear it or you can't hear anything?
Hardly anything. You shouldn't say of the Messiah, but it's like a rumbling train because the sound, instead of coming in through your ears, comes up through the throat, comes up through the larynx and inside and your skull. So it's a totally different sound, and I don't know that anybody has ever tried to create that sound, or if they could.
And that's one reason why hearing loss can be so isolating, whether you're a musician or not. It's hard to explain to other people. It takes away the things that you once enjoyed. The others in the room agree that losing their hearing profoundly changed the way they experience music. At times, it is physically uncomfortable, and any song with more than one instrument is nearly impossible to make out. So when they sit in front of Betty in a quiet room, as she plays a single viola, there is a chance they can hear her.
So you know that tune.
Danny Boy.
Yes.
Don't ask me why, but when I can hear her, you know, and it doesn't happen in other occasions, and so I know it can be done, and she's got the secret. God bless her.
It makes me so happy. I may be playing out of tune. I may not be at my peak of playing. I don't strive for that, and I love it when people tell me that they haven't been able to listen to music and enjoy it, and when they hear me play, they can, and that just gives me such joy.
And that is the sweetness on the other side of loss. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
One of China's biggest tech companies will no longer be able to buy components from the U.S. The U.S. Commerce Department is banning China's ZTE from buying American parts to make its smartphones and other products. The Commerce Department says the company did not punish employees who violated U.S. sanctions against Iran and North Korea. Ali Velshi is an MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, welcome.
Hey, Eric.
So first, can you explain a little bit? I mean, what does the Commerce Department say ZTE did? Because it's not just that they didn't punish these employees. They may have actually, what, rewarded them?
Yeah, so they had an agreement with the Commerce Department in March 2017 to plead guilty and pay a $1.1 billion fine for illegally shipping telecommunications equipment to North Korea and Iran. It's a Chinese cell phone maker, but they actually make most of their stuff and sell it out. They make it in China, and they sell about 40% of their phones and communications equipment outside of China. So they were shipping the stuff to North Korea and Iran. They promised to discipline the employees involved in the scheme. Not only did they not discipline them, they paid full bonuses to many of those employees,
wow,
and then they lied about it to the Commerce Department. So the U.S. Commerce Department has said it can no longer buy American components for its phones. And as you know, with all phones, including the iPhone, they're made from components around the world. Hmm. And in the U.K., their cybersecurity officials have warned British firms. It's not the same as the U.S. They haven't banned them, but they've warned British firms not to do business with ZTE.
Interesting. Britain has given them the warning. And China says that ZTE works with several hundred American companies, providing the U.S. with, you know, thousands of jobs. You know, what companies are involved? I mean, and is this a big deal for them?
Well, so generally speaking, the companies involved wouldn't be only dealing with ZTE, but like a lot of phone makers, a lot of components are common. So 43% of the sales of ZTE's phones in 2017 were outside China. There's a number of companies. Acacia Communications in the United States makes about a third of its revenue from ZT. It's based in New Jersey. Its shares fell 36%. Oclaro, another American company that makes optical components, its shares fell 15%. But Intel and Qualcomm are also ZTE's key suppliers, so that's a big deal. And by the way, a lot of these phones are made in Shenzhen and Hong Kong. Shenzhen is just on the Chinese side of the border from Hong Kong. It's about an hour away. It is suspended. ZTE has suspended its shares on the Shenzhen exchange, on the Hong Kong exchange. So this is a very, very big deal in the cell phone world.
Well, what does it mean for a big company like Qualcomm? I mean, earlier this week we saw Qualcomm's plan to buy a Dutch company, you know, maybe on hold because of China's involvement. Explain that and whether this is part of the trade dispute between the U.S. and China.
So it feels that way, right? This is how these things play out. Qualcomm has planned a $44 billion purchase of a Dutch semiconductor company. It's called NXP Semiconductors. Well, China gets to have a say on this because it's one of the countries in which the companies have substantial sales or assets. And of the companies that have to sign off on the deal, China is the only one that has not signed off. Now, it wasn't particularly about the ZTE thing, but China, it seems, is using this sign-off as leverage against Donald Trump's plan to impose tariffs on $150 billion worth of trade. So that's what the issue is. Now that deal by Qualcomm is on hold until the Chinese government tunes in on this thing. So it is, in larger part, it's part of the same trade dispute.
We'll be watching. Thanks, Ali.
All right, Eric.
Raul Castro leaves office this week after two terms as president of Cuba. He took power from his brother Fidel 12 years ago. Now, for the first time since the island's communist revolution in 1959, Cuba will not be run by a Castro. And the Castro family is leaving an uncertain legacy. Jorge Duany is head of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University in Miami. Jorge, how big a moment is this for Cuba?
From some purposes, it's a very important moment. It's the first time that there isn't a Castro heading the Cuban government. On the other hand, it appears that it's not going to be a watershed because Raul Castro, the current president, will stay behind the throne, so to speak. He will still be the head of the Communist Party in Cuba as well as the chief of the armed forces. And finally, he's been elected as a deputy in the National Assembly, which is the equivalent of Congress in Cuba.
So the man in front will be, or at least we expect it to be, his number two man, Miguel Díaz-Canel. We should say this is not a democratic process at all by which he becomes president. What can you tell us about him or Díaz-Canel with Castro right behind the scene?
Actually, one of the main virtues, if you will, of Miguel Díaz-Canel is that he's been having a very low profile since he was named vice president by the current president, Raul Castro. So he's been relatively reserved and discreet in his public pronouncements. He hasn't made any big public speeches like Fidel used to do. And only last year, we heard from him in a video that was leaked to the press that he's going to preserve the main party line in Cuba. And of course, that's necessary for him to be selected president. So we really don't know if he's going to be a Gorbachev type reformer or even a liberal, or perhaps more likely if he's just going to follow in the footsteps of his previous president.
Well, Raul Castro did not completely fall in his big brother's footsteps, Fidel's footsteps, during his two terms as president. He was known for his early attempt to transform the economy, allowing some private enterprise, economic liberalization. That was in 2011, although he pulled back on that in recent years. Did Raul Castro bring Cuba any closer to becoming a capitalist country, which was the fear of some of his detractors?
Not really. I mean, Raul always insisted that he was merely updating socialism in Cuba, meaning that he was going to do whatever was necessary for the socialist system to survive. So, in fact, what we do have is sort of a mixed economy in which central planning or state-run enterprises are still a dominant aspect of the economy. And then there's a smaller sector of the economy that's not controlled by the government, and that largely has to do with the so-called self-employed workers, or cuentapropistas in Spanish. And, of course, there's also a number of mixed capitalist and socialist enterprises. And finally, there's a whole sector of cooperatives in Cuba.
So the people who could, for instance, start up restaurants in their homes or kind of a small B&B in their homes, are they still allowed to do that now?
They are until at least last year when the government decided not to issue any more licenses for this kind of employment.
Why did it stop that?
Well, there was an earlier Congress in Cuba of the Communist Party in which members of the party expressed a concern with the growing enrichment of these private entrepreneurs and the growing inequality in income distribution. So it looks like the government was actually very concerned about these sort of outbursts of capitalism in a country that's supposed to be equal for all.
So what's the state of the Cuban economy now?
Right now, most of the economy is still controlled by the government, especially in areas like health or education, which are really not open to investment. But many other sectors of the economy are open to the international business community. And in fact, the Cuban government has been trying to lure millions and millions of dollars, especially in the free enterprise zone of Mariel. However, those efforts have not been productive until now.
Why not?
I think the bureaucracy is still too complicated, and many investors are not to feel safe investing in Cuba. But most of it is Chinese, Russian, Brazilian, and anything but U.S. For Cubans themselves, I think the last couple of years have meant an increase in the expectations that things will improve in the near future. Most people barely survive on a $20 or $25 salary. There's an aging population as well that barely meets ends with their pension funds and so on. But clearly the current moment in which the island is found, particularly with the U.S.-Cuba tension and the collapse of the Venezuelan economic and political system, that doesn't bode well for the Cuban future.
As Raul Castro prepares to leave, what is his legacy and the larger legacy of the Castro brothers?
I think at this time it's hard to assess the legacy of the Castro brothers, but certainly in the case of Raul, there were some significant improvements in the economic performance of the island, especially the opening up to the market and to more efficient systems of economic administration. On the other hand, on the political side, there was very little that Raul actually led in terms of, for instance, allowing multiple parties in Cuba or, taking care of a human rights situation on the island, which is not it's one of the worst, according to international organizations, and simply allowing freedom of expression and tolerance for different political opinions. I think on those counts, the legacy of Raul and in the long term of Fidel is very poor.
Okay, thank you. Jorge Duany, head of the Cuba Research Institute at Florida International University. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you.
Listeners in the Midwest who are once again seeing piles of snow out the window might be thinking spring is a little late to the lower 48. Well, spring comes a lot more slowly in Russia, where a third of the land is in the Arctic. It gets so cold in Vladivostok and Russia's Pacific coast that the sea freezes over. The ice is so thick that for the last 3 years, runners have been taking part in a race across the frozen bay. They come in from neighboring Asian countries, from Europe, and now from the United States. NPR's Lucian Kim took time off from a recent reporting trip to join the Vladivostok Ice Run.
It was about 10 degrees Fahrenheit when I got to the banks of Novik Bay, so the warm-up music was a good way to get the blood pumping. I meet Anastasia Vlasenko, the spokeswoman for the race. She says that everything's been checked out. The ice is more than 2 feet thick, and we're good to go.
All right, so I'm in the middle of a crowd of runners from 10 different countries. We're just waiting for the start of the 10K. The big boys and big girls have already left on the half marathon an hour ago.
I meet Tim Stanley, an Englishman living in Moscow, who's taken an eight-hour flight to run the race.
I haven't prepared enough. I've done a lot of internal gym sessions, but it's my first time on the ice, and it's my first time training outside. So.
I ask him what he's wearing, besides the spikes strapped over his running shoes.
Three layers on the top, two layers on the bottom half. I got three pairs of socks on, two pairs of gloves, hat, neckerchief, sunglasses against the glare, and we've got loads of baby lotion on our faces.
Here we go. No start gun, just a countdown. You can hear the grinding of spikes on ice. This will be the sound for the next 10 kilometers or 6 miles. Ice is a funny surface to run on. So it's not really slick because there's a lot of texture on the ice. But until you feel that your toes have really got that grip, it makes everything a little bit more exciting. There's 2 miles to go. High in the sky, I have the sun beating down my face in front of me, a sheet of white ice, and on the horizon, rolling brown and blue hills. Absolutely beautiful.
Smile!
Finally, I cross the finish line and am greeted with a medal. Everybody gets a medal. I bump into Artyom Nevalyanov, a Russian soldier who just ran the half marathon in an hour and a half. He can't believe it took me an hour to run half that distance. He lets me into his secret. You need to get a good coach. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Vladivostok.
Gentrification is reshaping cities, bringing in new development, displacing longtime residents, and raising rents. One example of this change is the Philadelphia neighborhood called Strawberry Mansion. In a matter of decades, it's gone from being one of the city's wealthiest neighborhoods to one of its poorest, from being predominantly white to majority black. And now Strawberry Mansion seems poised to change yet again, and black residents are concerned that gentrification is going to push them out. Jen Kinney from member station WHYY reports on a neighborhood in flux.
How you been? I've been good. What about yourself?
Tanetta Graham is walking around Strawberry Mansion, a neighborhood she's lived in all her life.
All right, love you too.
If it's going to gentrify, she wants to make sure existing residents aren't left behind. After college, she could have left for good, but instead, she moved home.
I made a decision that I was going to stay in Philadelphia and that if I wanted to stay in Strawberry Mansion, that I was going to just help make it better.
At that point, Strawberry Mansion had gone through many transformations. It had been a wealthy Jewish neighborhood until the 1940s. When many white families left for the suburbs, black families, like Graham's, were able to purchase houses, cheap.
My grandmother was one of them. She did day work for a Jewish family that owned the house that she eventually bought.
Now that housing prices are beginning to rise in the neighborhood, Graham isn't afraid of those changes. She just wants to make sure those families can keep their homes and benefit from all the good things that more wealth could bring.
That's a misconception that a lot of people have. Like, oh, they wanted to stay the same. We don't. We want to see growth and development. We want to see restaurants or eateries. We want quality schools as well. We just don't want to be planned over.
That fear has been alive in the neighborhood a long time.
This thing in Strawberry Mansion that I grew up with was they're coming. They want the neighborhood back. They was never really defined, but you know, that was the term where they're coming. And we kind of saw some of those things happening in neighborhoods next to us.
You said it was never really defined who they was, but like, who did you think that it was?
White people. That's what it was, white people.
White people. That's me. I moved to Strawberry Mansion a little over a year ago. My roommate, who owns the house, was the first white person on our block in decades. Here's our neighbor, LaTanya Reed, describing our arrival.
So the block was just like, oh my gosh, like we're being like integrated. What is going on? And I was like, the gentrification is happening. And they're like, what is the gentrification? And I'm just like, so I had to explain the whole thing to them and why they shouldn't panic. Because it was just like, okay, pardon my French. It was just like, oh my God, these white girls are moving in. These hippie white girls and her dog, and they were just sitting out on the porch drinking beer. And I'm like, but we all sit out on the porch drinking beer.
Now, to say Strawberry Mansion is gentrifying might seem like a stretch. It's long been one of Philadelphia's poorest neighborhoods. But housing prices are shooting up fast in nearby neighborhoods. And slowly, development is creeping over to Strawberry Mansion.
It's a very quiet block. The people are very friendly.
That's Damaris Walker. He moved to Strawberry Mansion 9 years ago and started buying properties.
The houses are very large, and they have so much a character. It was like, I love it at first sight.
Walker sold my roommate our house. Now he owns 5 on our block alone. And even though Walker is black, his purchases raised eyebrows, especially when he sold to a white woman.
There were African Americans who I hope would buy it. and some didn't qualify for the mortgage. The saddest part to me was that there were people who I thought should give the neighborhood a chance who looked like me, who had sort of written it off because they thought the price was too high for the hood.
Tanetta Graham knows people outside the neighborhood, black and white, were bound to see Strawberry Mansion's great qualities sooner or later.
But one thing that we have to make sure that they do see is that homeowners are still here. So you may see the vacant land, you may see a lot of the rundown buildings, but you also there are also some homeowners that have stuck through all of those transitional periods and are not going anywhere.
More than a decade ago, seeing change on the horizon, Graham and other residents founded the Strawberry Mansion Community Development Corporation. She thought the neighborhood needed an organization to protect and advocate for existing residents.
We know that our strength is in our homeownership. They don't value our houses at much, but we do own them.
But protecting homeowners is tricky. Graham gives an example. Say the city values your home at $20,000 and a developer comes along and says he'll pay $60,000 for it.
For someone who's uneducated about what's going on, you think, I'm going to get over because I'm going to make a, what, $40,000 profit. But in actuality, if you get that 60, where are you going to be able to purchase another house? If a lot of us fall for that, then you're not going to have the opportunity to come back to a neighborhood.
Some amenities are in the process of returning to Strawberry Mansion, too. There's a private preschool, an environmental center, and eventually Graham thinks banks and grocery stores will also return. When they do, she wants to make sure they're for current residents, not just future, wealthier, and probably whiter ones. For Here and Now, I'm Jen Kinney.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.